Welcome to a very special edition of Enclave On Air. I'm your host today, Gina Columbus. Enclave On Air is a podcast from Enclave, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Enclave covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. But today, we had the pleasure of sitting down with Beth Y. Carlin, MD, Vice Chair of Women's Health Research and Director of Cancer Population Genetics at the University of California, Los Angeles, David Geffen School of Medicine. Dr. Carlin has dedicated her career to improving care for women with cancer by fast-tracking translation scientific discoveries to the bedside, shaping current standards of care, and training the next generation of physicians and scientists. Her efforts have led to the discovery of HE4. HE4 testing is now an FDA-approved method to help assess women with a pelvic mass and to help monitor for recurrence in those with ovarian cancer. Additional achievements by Dr. Carlin include serving as the co-principal investigator for the BRCA Founder Outreach Study, also known as B4, which is conducting population-based BRCA genetic testing on 4,000 eligible adults of Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry. Moreover, in 2012, President Barack Obama appointed Dr. Carlin to the National Cancer Advisory Board. She has also served as past president of the Society of Gynecologic Oncology and currently serves as editor-in-chief for Gynecologic Oncology and Gynecologic Oncology Reports. From hearing these accolades, it's no surprise that Dr. Carlin was recognized as the 2019 Enclave Giant of Cancer Care in Gynecologic Cancers. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Carlin shared the rewarding moments as well as challenges navigating the cancer space as a female oncologist, pivotal research she has spearheaded that has had lasting impacts on the field, and other developments in gynecologic cancers that are poised to change the landscape forever.
First off, why did you want to specialize in oncology and what path led you to the gynecologic cancer field specifically?
From a young age, I was really very fascinated by a basic question of what makes a normal cell different from a cancer cell. Some of my family had had cancer. I was already taking high school biology and was intrigued with what might be driving these abnormal cancer cells to grow, to spread, and ultimately to take someone's life. In terms of how I became focused on gynecologic cancers, I think part of my time through high school and college, and then even in medical school, I recognize I really do think women are the stronger sex, that the struggle that women with cancer faced really resonated with me. I think having been chosen OBGYN and seeing firsthand how women faced the ups and downs of health and disease and life really made me want to fight for them, with them, to help preserve the most and the best life that we could.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. And I know this kind of actually segues very nicely into the next question as to what really lies behind your passion to fight this gynecologic cancers. And is there anything that, you know, you face in your life that it comes from that, or what really lies behind that type of passion that you have?
I have had many personal challenges that I have seen and taken hold of along with my patients as they fight their cancer battles and I fight along with them. But it's also a passion that comes from observed inequities in a focus on women's health and funding for cancer care and women's cancers. I've really felt that I could help amplify the voice of patients and their families to garner additional resources, education, public awareness, advocacy, so we can see some of the advances that have been appreciated in other cancers. I think I have grit. I hate to lose. And I will continue on this fight, really, until, you know, we can truly see patients living their full lives despite having cancer.
Thank you. What I also want to kind of talk about is whether, obviously you've had tons and tons of patients, but is there any, like, one or two patients in particular that, you know, either they really changed your practice or they have just really had a lasting impact on your career?
As I've been alluding to, I do try to really understand the medical and some of the personal struggles of my patients, and they really have shaped my career. One of the reasons I went into gynecologic oncology was, even as a medical student, a patient I was caring for challenged me with sort of a question of, you know, why did she was about my age, I should say that. She was unfortunately dying from ovarian cancer and asked me the question of what right did I have to be healthy and pursue my dreams when she was at that time in bed and struggling with her ovarian cancer. And I really took that question to heart and said I wanted to better understand as much as I could why some bad things can happen to some very good people who, you know, have done nothing wrong. And we always say, you know, cancer has no prejudice. It doesn't, you know, it strikes all individuals equally and is, you know, colorblind, sex blind. But I've really tried to understand cancer risk factors, penetrance of disorders. In fellowship, I had multiple patients who shaped the way I practice as well, trying to understand why they got disease versus someone else, but also they helped remind me what matters most in life, and that since one does not know when one's going to be healthy or not, to really make the most of every day. And then throughout my practice, early on, I saw many of the familial clusterings of cancers and really began to better understanding of the genetic transmission of cancer as a trait, as an autosomal dominant trait that's passed down from one generation to the next, and really begin our research to look at early detection, markers of penetrance, and search for biomarkers that could help us find cancers early, and then markers even towards prevention.
Would I be able to ask you to kind of expand a little bit on some of the biomarker work that have been done? That's a really great point and kind of how we've seen that evolution.
Early on in my research, I recognized that there was a great diversity in the way disease, a given cancer, and my focus as a gynecologic oncologist has been on ovarian cancer, but how it behaved in one patient versus another. And I vividly, you know, remember two patients doing the surgery on the same day, having the same surgical outcomes, no visible disease, and recovering from their procedures, yet one patient ultimately passed away within 2 years, and another one was alive for, you know, over 10 years, and really trying to understand what was different about the cancers. So we began to collect tumors from the patients, again, with institutional review board reviews and patient consent, but began to collect tumors from patients undergoing surgery so that we can have thousands of patients' tumors that we could then correlate with their clinical outcomes. So, you know, genotype doesn't mean a lot without phenotype, and being a clinician surgeon on the front line, I was able to collect many of those tumors to understand the genetics and then correlate it with the outcomes so we could do marker discovery. At the same time, I was very much aware that we're really good at curing early stage ovarian cancer when we are fortunate enough to find it at stage one. Better than 90% of patients will truly be cured of the tumor. So we also began looking for those cases when we had opportunities to collect them, to look for markers that were different in the early tumors, different than the late tumors, different than the normal tissue, and begin to do discovery. And as technology advanced and we were able to do microarrays and, you know, increasing understanding of the genes, the modifiers, how they do transmit their signals from, you know, genomics to transcriptomics, we've begun, well, we looked for over 20 years at different biomarkers. And we found some that are FDA approved, or one, I should say, called HE4, that helps differentiate when cancers recur along with CA125, can help determine if a mass might be malignant or benign. But we're still really searching for a reliable, reproducible marker that will let us know when someone is, you know, either has a precancer or an early cancer, so that we can intervene then. But the idea of having biomarkers that can let us know prognosis, which treatments may work, is something that I think we're all looking for now, and it's really undergone a transformative change itself in terms of how we initially just looked for surface peptides to now looking at, you know, extracellular vesicles, exosomes, RNA species, and other molecules that may indeed predict either the occurrence of a cancer or the outcomes of a cancer. It's been a team effort with many collaborators, and in fact, to collect these cases, collaborators, you know, internationally. One of the most rewarding things has been to learn from my colleagues and to be part of these large collaborations where we're all really rowing in the same direction to understand the outcomes, the penetrance, who's going to get a cancer, who's not, and ultimately with an eye to prevention. Once we see these markers, perhaps in my dream, they would be a target. They would be targetable, or understanding a way to regulate them to actually prevent cancers short of doing, you know, risk-reducing surgeries, which is so much of what we do today.
Thank you so much. That's a really nice overview of a lot of great work that's been going on. Is there other, I know I'm going a little bit out of order here, but is there additional research that you've been a part of throughout your career that has had a really significant impact that you would like to share? And what was it like to be part of that kind of research?
One of the reasons for me to be in academic medicine is the freedom to be able to pursue a new truth, to look into something that may not have been understood, and to do so with a dogged enthusiasm that hopefully brings others along to work with us. That came early on, again, a lot around early detection. It transformed to biomarkers, but soon after I completed my fellowship, having taken care of many women with advanced ovarian cancer, and before we had Taxol and, you know, so many of the drugs we can use today to really help better allow patients to live longer, I recognized the fact that we can cure early-stage ovarian cancer. So I launched the Gilda Radner Ovarian Cancer Detection Program. Gilda Radner I was the fellow, but I helped care for her, and her husband, Gene Wilder, after she passed away, really wanted to help raise awareness of ovarian cancer and a focus on this need for early detection. And we put together an early program. We used imaging, we used color Doppler flow, which in those days was brand new. It was a way to image the vessels that went to the ovary, the very small vessels, and the idea that there would be different patterns of flow and impedance in the vessel with a cancerous vessel versus a normal vessel. So we used these ultrasound techniques, we used biomarkers, we used family history, because it's before BRCA 1 and 2 was appreciated. So we looked at women at high risk due to family histories and began the screening. It was a really early entree for me to team science, to bringing in medical geneticists, ultrasonographers, radiologists, surgeons, and the private practice OBGYN community to really sort of focus on this very important question. Our work, our findings in those early years really did help shape some of the national guidelines, which have continued to evolve over time. But I was always interested in this familial clustering, and with the discovery of BRCA1 and BRCA2 and subsequently the Lynch syndrome genes, it really further focused my career on cancer genetics and on the importance of education about cancer genetic testing, about the role it can play for both understanding predisposition and risk, but also now with the FDA approval of multiple PARP inhibitors, how that genetic testing really can help provide better treatment for patients. So my initial interest in the familial clusterings and understanding of ovarian cancer biology started with screening, evolved towards biomarkers, focused on genetics, and now we're working in California on initiatives to try to really democratize access to care for cancer genetic testing so that more individuals and their families can be armed with this important information to take control and make decisions for themselves with regards to prevention opportunities, interventions, and other treatment possibilities that may indeed help them live longer and live better.
And we've seen certain agents like the PARP inhibitors obviously have quite a significant impact for select patients with ovarian cancer and obviously those with the BRCA1/2 mutations. What has it been like for you to kind of see this evolution of this more targeted therapy make waves in gynecologic cancers? And I was just reading something earlier today about how they might also have an impact in patients with endometrial cancer that have BRCA mutation. So I know this is another off-the-cuff question, but if you have any thoughts on that.
It's been very rewarding to go now a next step beyond the discovery of the BRCA 1 and 2 genes with regards to predisposition and risk, to now actually see them as targets for treatment. And with the understandings of synthetic lethality and how BRCA 1 and 2 work within the cell and understanding those pathways with regards to homologous recombination, DNA repair, and the deficiency caused by mutations in these genes, we've been able to discover agents that target them. We were involved very early on in some of the initial clinical trials, and I indeed had one patient on those early trials who spent 8 years on PARP inhibitors. She had stage 4 ovarian cancer when we began the PARP inhibitor. She was actually just about on TPN and couldn't eat and had a complete resolution and was able to remain on it for 8 years. She had a BRCA2 mutation. Seeing the excitement and seeing the benefit has been incredibly rewarding to be able to have a really individualized, personalized approach. However, with the excitement comes a bit of hype and hope, especially for women battling ovarian cancer. And the cells, the cancer cells, can develop resistance to PARP inhibitors. So while it's been very rewarding to have another effective treatment in my armamentarium to treat women with ovarian cancer, I've also seen women where the PARP inhibitor doesn't really work, doesn't give them as much time as we had all hoped for. But thank goodness, with the number of clinical trials, the amount of research ongoing, we right now have a good pipeline of other agents that might also be useful in treating them. I think the other thing that the advent of PARP inhibitors remind me is that while these aren't cures for advanced stage disease, they are incremental improvements. When I was a resident in training, the median survival of women with ovarian cancer was 18 months. We didn't have taxanes. We didn't have so many of the newer agents, forget even just Avastin and PARP inhibitors and other agents along the way. And now women with ovarian cancer have median survivals well in excess of 5 years, which still is not cure, is not long enough, but we are able to really shift that survival curve with agents like PARP inhibitors. And I think as we have these incremental benefits, it's another call to us in the scientific community to make sure we do have runway for the next treatment and the next treatment to allow these women to really live out full lives.
Thank you so much. So I'm going to turn it back over more to your career. And I know we've talked a lot of really exciting things I've been a part of. Is there anything else in terms of like what has been your most proudest moment as well as the most challenging thing that you've had to deal with in your career?
Professionally, one of my proudest moments was being the president of the Society of Gynecologic Oncology. It was a very exciting time of transition for the society, becoming a real standalone organization. And I also had an opportunity during that time to testify before Congress in support of passage of Johanna's Law, which is the Gynecologic Cancer Awareness and Education Act, and really spend time in the halls in Washington trying to raise awareness about the importance to focus on messaging. There's lots of science we do in perhaps at times our ivory towers, but making that information and discovery available to everybody is so important. As we look at that implementation of the new science, the new technologies out to the public. I also testified with regards to increasing funding for ovarian cancer research, which is something that is vitally needed for us to continue to have and accelerate the pace of discoveries. In terms of challenges, there are many, many challenges. You know, I think anyone, you know, balancing professional and personal goals, being married, having two kids, juggling carpool soccer practices, being a surgeon, wanting to have an academic career, travel, and having a marriage, and making sure that all those other aspects stay intact along with my career goals was a challenge. It was a different time, and you just had to fight through a lot of it. I had a real passion to make a difference as a gynecologic oncologist, and I think that my family understood that, and I'm very proud of what they're doing now. But there were lots of biases, and we talk about various implicit bias today. Back in those days, it wasn't always implicit bias, but proving that women can make a difference in a surgical specialty. I was told when I interviewed for fellowship that it just wasn't worth their time to train women, that we were going to have families and never you know, and never practice, or that you weren't going to be strong enough to even stand up through the cases that were quite long. After I got through those physical, you know, overcame those physical biases at times, you know, there wasn't even maternity leave policies. So, you know, petitioning to have an extra week after my 2 weeks vacation to be at home was a little, you know, people looked at it a little bit, you know, was she ever going to come back? And I had to prove to them on those fronts that I could. But there have always, of course, been challenges, clinical trials that were difficult, where patients had, you know, there are toxicities associated with clinical trial participation that are unanticipated. And being part of a trial when a patient experiences those toxicities took me to heart about, you know, the old primum non nocere, it first do no harm. And by doing clinical research and seeing these toxicities, despite all the informed consent, et cetera, still made me go back and question and think about how I can send patients to clinical trials moving forward. But those were really challenges that, you know, that I very much took to heart and, at least professionally, and carried forward in how I practice.
That's a really great point, just in how you really navigated such a work-life balance, and especially when there's no maternity leave. I find that to be so interesting.
But none.
That's crazy.
There was no policy.
Yeah, that's insane to me. But I wonder now, like, if you could give advice to other female oncologists, and maybe they're kind of at that point in their life where they're, you know, trying to start a family and they're trying to navigate how to balance such a obviously hectic career and personal life, what advice would you give them?
Everybody is different, and it's fine to collect stories and experiences from others and even your peers who are wonderful to offer support. But you need to look at your own life, your own goals, what drives you. Having mentors is incredibly helpful. They sort of can help block you on the field. Having support from your partner, spouse, little things, you know, pay for services that you can, you know, meaning if someone could deliver your dry cleaning to you and you don't have to worry about making the stop home after a very, very long day, you know, that's worth it. Paying for folks to make sure you're comfortable if you need to go to a meeting, that there's people around to help. There's a real bonus to being able to have to be an oncologist to help the men and women we treat through their illness and through their journey. And you can't put a price on that. That really is priceless. So that if you are having to spend some of your earnings for these other, in these other ways, it's definitely worth it for you to do that. Your kids, your family know your dedication to them, but also to your profession. And I think that doing that with as little guilt as possible. I think we all get a bit of doubt and imposter syndrome, and can we really do this? There's often social mores around us, but you can make a real difference in so many people's lives and still, and really set examples for your family about how to walk that walk, how to talk that talk, and follow their own dreams. And I think that that lesson, living that lesson for them, will allow your kids, if you have them, to to really go forward with the intent to make the world a better place as well.
That is some great advice. I think I want to step into really, and I think you've kind of weaved this in a little bit throughout the interview, but really, what is a motto that you live by in your daily practice?
If I had to give it a motto, so to speak, there are things like carpe diem, make the most of every day, take no days for granted, and live life to its fullest. I think those are the types of things. And then there's a Hebrew motto or saying of tikkun olam, which is to make the world a better place and to leave the world better when you are gone. And I think that those two, make the most of every day and try to leave the world a little bit of a better place, is really what I try to do every day. And I think gratitude, and it's not really a motto, but I will say reflecting, I do reflect daily the sense of thanks and gratitude for the opportunities I've had to pursue this journey, this dream for me.
That's great. That's fantastic. Thank you so much. I'm thinking in closing, maybe we look kind of towards the future, and if there's anything you want to share that's next for you, your research, your career, or just kind of looking towards the future of gynecologic cancer treatment in general, what you think the future holds.
Mm-hmm. I hope that in the future, with the increased knowledge that is coming out right now, we can really focus more efforts on prevention. Even better than curing cancer is never getting cancer at all. So really understanding better ways to live healthier lives, to have targeted agents, and we really can do precision prevention, but also focusing on implementation of this existing knowledge, helping people understand that there are actions that they can take to allow them to live healthier and better lives. We continue to have cultural divides, cultural mores that lead to a horrible fear of cancer. We can't even speak the word. And I really hope with this work, we can change the perception of the fear of cancer as a death sentence, to changing it to, when I say just, but it's to a serious condition, whether it's diabetes or high blood pressure or heart disease, but it's something you can live with, that there are medications that we can treat, and despite having cancer, you can live a full life and continue to pursue your dreams. I always tell my patients that we're going to try to help them live with cancer, where the live is in 40 font bold, but we try to keep the cancer in sort of 6 or 8 font, little italicized letters, that they really have to focus on the living, and that we will do our best to keep the cancer to a meow and not a roar. I'm not saying it's going to go away, but that you can live your life by accepting your mortality, that death is not an option. It really helps. And cancer is that very teachable moment where you sort of come to face with it, that it really reminds you to make the most of every day, that they're not infinite. So when you see your kids, you hug them, you see your friends, your loved ones, you remind yourself just how lucky you are, and you make the most of the opportunities in front of you and those relationships.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this special episode of Enclave On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews with top KOLs in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave and at EnclaveSOSS. on Facebook, like us at Enclave and Enclave State of the Science Summit, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Enclave On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave On Air.